It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. And for Rob Ferret, coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at the words and phrases that defined 2014.
First, Wisconsin is on track to have the lowest number of road deaths in the state since 1943. At the end of last week, there were 480 deaths. And if that number stays below 500 through the end of the year, it will be a seven-decade low.
Wisconsin's on par with similar states like Minnesota for the number of road deaths, but fall short of the national average for seatbelt usage by 1% at 85%.
As we head into the full swing of holiday season and more drivers are out on the road, David Papps joins us. He's the director of the Bureau of Safety at the Department of Transportation. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Compared to where we are this year, how does that compare to other years in terms of road deaths in Wisconsin?
Well, right now we're running about 37 fewer than we had at this time last year. Last year was a record low number for us since the 1940s as well. We had 527 deaths. So right now we're at 480 overall, and we're hoping to have less than 500 this year.
Do you have a sense of how Wisconsin compares with other states, maybe of the similar size when it comes to road deaths?
Well, Wisconsin is part of NHTSA Region 5, and as part of Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois, our death rate, if you will, is, you know, very comparable. So Minnesota has, you know, deaths around the same amounts that we do. Some other states have more. But overall, the entire region has experienced a reduction in deaths.
When there are fatalities on the road, what's the usual cause?
Well, usually it's a human factor. You could be speeding, not wearing your seatbelt, not paying attention, or drinking and driving. Some of those are real common things that happen. People don't pay attention. Distraction while driving is a huge problem we have now. It's starting to overtake some of our other common problems. OWI, of course, is still really a big problem for us as well. And, of course, people need to slow down and pay attention.
Now, as you said, we're below the level of last year when it comes to road deaths. What do you attribute the drop to?
Well, it's many factors. There's engineering of our highways is better. We're putting in median rumble strips as well as shoulder rumble strips that the dozy driver can, you know, be awakened by that sound and prevent a head-on collision. We're using roundabouts. Roundabouts are a great intersection device, if you will, that prevents T-bone crashes. Now, there are some crashes involved, but they're always a glancing blow, so they're not nearly as violent. So roundabout is a simple solution to intersection crashes, and we're seeing reductions in fatalities from that. Also, traffic incident management is a huge thing. So when you do have a pileup, officers are trained to clear the scene quickly so you don't have secondary crashes. A lot of those engineering-type things are contributing to a reduction in deaths. Another engineering thing that people do not consider is the safety of the cars themselves has increased so much more so. Cars now have multiple airbags instead of just one on the steering wheel. They have electronic stability control, which helps people to stay out of trouble. In the past, you might lose control on an icy road. The cars now help you maintain control because of the electronic stability programming. So we're seeing safer cars, safer roads, but people are being safer as well. Wisconsin is buckling up more than they ever have. We're at about 85%. We're lagging behind the central states here in seatbelt use. We need to get it up higher. The national average is 86%. We're at 85%, and we're just continuing to enforce the seatbelt laws and make people aware of the safety benefits of wearing your seatbelt. So we're getting that up higher each year.
Well, to look a little more closely at the seatbelt issue, why do you think that Wisconsinites have started wearing their seatbelts more often? What's changed?
Well, what's changed, I think, are people are listening to the programming and the initiatives we have. We have Click It or Ticket initiatives where we advertise along with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. We put spots out, educational stops, and also Wisconsin went to a primary seat law where now you can be stopped for just not wearing your seatbelt. And so people are taking it more seriously and are buckling up. as more people buckle up, the more lives we save.
In terms of distracted driving, that is something that's it's a perennial concern these days. A lot of the times, people on their cell phones are of concern to other drivers, and Wisconsin drivers are allowed to use handheld phones while they're on the road. Do you consider that a safety risk?
It is a safety risk. Anytime you're on the phone, whether you're just holding the phone or using a hands-free headset, you are cognitively distracted. And statistics show that you are four times more likely to be involved in a crash just by being on the phone. Now, if you add texting into that mix, and especially the younger generation that likes to text, they don't have the same driving skills some of us older drivers do, and then you add texting, it's a recipe for disaster. You text, a simple text takes about 5 seconds to compose and send. 5 seconds on the road at highway speeds, that's the length of a football field that you're not looking where you're supposed to be driving and paying attention. So texting and driving is really bad, and so is just using a phone. Phones themselves, like I say, four times more likely to be involved in a crash if you're just using the phone.
Now, you can tell people not to use their phones and not to text and talk while they're driving, but changing the law is another thing. Do you think that we should be looking at a legal solution to this?
Well, we already have looked at a legal solution. There's laws in place, of course, in place for distracted driving already. We've always had that, inattentive driving, and it's just a matter of using some of the tools we already have. And we do have the anti-texting law, and if you have a probationary license or are under GDL, you can't use phones except to dial 911. We have looked at some of those solutions, and sometimes they're really difficult to enforce, but we're using the tools that we have to the best of our abilities.
Other states are looking at making it illegal to use phones at all. Do you think Wisconsin should do that?
That's up to the voters to decide if we should or shouldn't do that, but my recommendation is that we should really look closely at all distractions in vehicles and make sure that we minimize them to the best of our ability.
You know, roundabouts, you mentioned engineering solutions, and roundabouts are sometimes contentious. People sometimes feel that they cause more accidents. Sometimes people don't like them in their neighborhoods. Do you think that people are sold on the safety of roundabouts, or does more work need to be done to educate people?
I think there's always more work to be done when it comes to educating people about traffic safety, and roundabouts is a perfect example where there are a lot of them. It's a new concept for us here in the United States and especially in Wisconsin, and we are putting them in because they're very cost-effective and very safe. Naturally, you know, it's kind of a passive thing where you go in the circle, and as long as you take it slow as you go through there and get familiar with it, what we're finding is a lot of people who were dead set against them now are embracing them because they realize, you know what, this isn't so bad once you get used to it. But our mindset, some of us, in our 50s, it's really new and it's harder for us to change. And if you're even older than that, you have a lot of set patterns, and so it's harder for us to maybe adapt. But once they do adapt, we are finding that people are actually endorsing them.
In terms of the numbers we've been talking about, fewer deaths this year, are there also fewer car crashes, or are there just fewer fatalities?
There's actually fewer fatal crashes. And another piece of the fatality picture that we didn't talk about is OWI. And over the last 10 years, OWI fatalities have been reduced since 2003 to 2013. There's been a 47% reduction in alcohol-related fatalities. That's huge, and that's helping us drive these numbers down.
Wisconsin does still stand out in the nation for having the highest percentage of drunk drivers and for being the only state where a first drunk driving offense isn't a criminal offense. Do you think that anything needs to change when you look at that?
We are making huge impacts on how people are drinking and driving right now through the use of OWI task forces. There are 15 of them spread throughout the state, and every month we're adding more. And what we're finding is that when law enforcement is getting out there, getting the word out through media and social media that we are actually going to be out there enforcing, it affects the way people behave. They're still going to go to the bar and drink, but what they decide to do is get a safe ride home, call a friend, have a designated driver, and we're actually impacting how people are celebrating. So they're going to still celebrate, but once they're done, they're taking safer options to get home.
We're just heading into the thick of the holiday season. A lot of people are going to be out on the roads. New Year's Eve is part of this whole celebratory season we've got coming up. Do you have any advice for drivers out there who are going to be on the road about how to drive safe and drive defensively?
Well, first of all, just pay attention to the hour of night that you're driving. Of course, later as bars close and whatnot, the percentage of other people that are out there possibly having imbibed are greater. So you just want to be aware of that. So plan accordingly. Try to get early and maybe stay overnight wherever you're at. I recommend that if you are going to be out celebrating, that you designate your driver in advance. So you have that person that's going to be doing the soda or water or whatever their choice is so that they are actually sober for the ride home. And the other thing you can do, of course, is just encourage everybody at your party and remind them at the beginning that, you know, if you're unable to drive or you feel even slightly buzzed, let's stay here. Let's not go anywhere. Let's just stay and enjoy the moment and then drive home later in the morning.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
That was David Papps, director of the Bureau of Safety at the Department of Transportation. Wisconsin is on track to have the lowest number of road deaths in the state since 1943. The family of Dontre Hamilton is now seeking a federal probe of Hamilton's death after the Milwaukee County District Attorney announced today that he won't issue criminal charges against the now fired white police officer who shot Hamilton in April. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Hamilton's family and their supporters have been marching for months asking Milwaukee County DA John Chisholm to charge former officer Christopher Manning with a crime. The family argues it was wrong for Manning to shoot Dontre Hamilton 14 times at a downtown Milwaukee park during an altercation. DA Chisholm says late last week he got a report back from the Pennsylvania consultant he'd hired to review a state of Wisconsin report on the shooting, and Chisholm says that review helped convince him not to charge Manny. Chisholm says the now-fired police officer acted as he was trained and authorized to do.
They're allowed to employ force to stop the threat, and as long as that threat is present, they are authorized to use force. In reviewing this case, we came to the conclusion that based on all the facts, all the circumstances present to a reasonable officer in Officer Manny's position at the time the circumstance occurred, that his use of force was privileged and was justified.
But Chisholm's decision not to try to send Christopher Manny to jail doesn't mean the Hamilton case is over. At a midday news conference on the steps of the Milwaukee Federal Courthouse, Hamilton family attorney Alex Flynn said turning to civil court for a lawsuit or to the federal government is next.
And we intend to exhaust every conceivable resource and every conceivable avenue to get justice for this really, really good family.
Flynn says he's asking the U.S. Attorney in Milwaukee to look into the shooting of Dontre Hamilton and also study the patterns and practices of the Milwaukee Police Department, given other cases where African-American men have died during interactions with police. Two civil rights groups, the ACLU and NAACP, are supporting the Hamiltons. Milwaukee NAACP chapter leader James Hall says the lack of criminal charges against Officer Manny is disappointing and says Dontre Hamilton was doing nothing wrong.
This outcome with regard to Mr. Hamilton harkens back to the days of Jim Crow, when a black life could be taken with impunity.
Milwaukee DA John Chisholm says Officer Manny did try to avoid shooting Hamilton, despite Hamilton taking Manny's baton and striking the officer with it after Manny struck Hamilton.
Multiple witnesses heard multiple verbal commands throughout the entire encounter. It was stop, get down, just the variations of that.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says if there is a federal probe of the Hamilton case or the police department, he'd cooperate.
I think that this police department is trying to do what it can to make sure that it is in compliance. I don't think it's a situation like you have in some other communities where the probes have begun. But again, I will certainly work with the Justice Department or anyone in Washington, D.C. to make sure that their concerns are addressed here.
In the meantime, Barrett is calling for any demonstrations reacting to the lack of charges against Officer Manny to be peaceful. A march that started right after the Hamilton's news conference and included more than 100 people going down city streets blocked some traffic but was nonviolent. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee.
as 2014 comes to a close, we're taking a look back at the year that was. Over the next couple of days, we'll be looking at the top news stories, music, and scientific discoveries that came to define the year. But we'll start our review with a look back at some of the words that stood out in 2014.
Each year, new words come and go. And while only some of them stick around for the long haul, it's fun to look back and remember the words and phrases that helped define the past year. And it gives us a fascinating look into our culture.
Joining us now is Ben Zimmer. He's a linguist and the executive editor of Vocabulary.com and VisualThesaurus.com. He's also the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Ben, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So looking back at your list of words of the year, it seems like there were a lot of words that kind of exploded and then kind of fizzled out. We may not even remember them now. What do you think it takes to get a word to really stick around?
Well, that's a good question. It's very difficult often to tell what will stick around. Something may indeed seem very important at the time, and within years or even months afterwards, we've forgotten what it was all about. And so we're looking for words and phrases with staying power that might be able to live beyond their immediate context in which they became popular. Very often words that stick around are ones that can apply to lots of different contexts. And so that's often a good recipe for success word in the future.
Now, one of your favorite words which may fit into that category is vortex. Could you talk a little bit about that word?
Right. Well, you know, that's not a new word.
No.
The word vortex has been around for quite a while, but it's being used in new ways, for sure. We heard quite a lot about the polar vortex this year. That phrase isn't necessarily new either. I wrote in the Wall Street Journal about how you can actually trace it back all the way to Dickensian times. It first shows up back in 1853 in a magazine that Charles Dickens himself edited. But we heard about the polar vortex. Most people who are not experts on weather or climate first heard about it back in January, and I'm sure that Wisconsinites know all about the polar vortex and the cold weather that it brought. And we've heard about it again now that the weather has turned cold again. And it's interesting, too, because now you can just say vortex and people will understand what you mean. I noticed that L.L. Bean was advertising vortex-proof gear. so that just shows how that word has really taken on this
But for somebody like you, does that sound completely silly when somebody says vortex proof gear or whatever?
I'm sorry?
Does it sound silly to you as a language person to hear?
It doesn't sound silly, but it shows the way that people's understanding of the word is changing. Just because of polar vortex being in the news so much, we're seeing that word vortex being used. Also, I think people are sort of drawn to that word vortex to describe all sorts of different experiences too. Before Jeb Bush announced that he was jumping into the 2016 presidential race, he talked about how he was worried about getting sucked into the vortex. So it's a very evocative word, and people are using it in all sorts of different ways this year.
Well, a word that may not have quite the broad applications of vortex is one that you like from the world of politics. You like the word cromnibus.
Well, that's a very interesting kind of mashup. It's a blend. If you're familiar with the way legislation works in Congress, very often there's an omnibus, which is a big spending bill that passed by Congress, and that got mashed up this year with the abbreviation CR for continuing resolution. So this was kind of very inside politics for Capitol Hill, but that combination of CR plus omnibus becoming cromnibus created the spending bill that Congress actually passed to avert a government shutdown. And it was a funny-sounding word, and, you know, people in Congress themselves were kind of making fun of it. Nancy Pelosi said it's like a cronut, which was a blend from 2013, the hybrid of a croissant and a donut. It was kind of a lighthearted word, even though obviously the political stakes were very high to get this bill passed.
Another political term that is popular this year, maybe not new necessarily, is dark money, right?
Yeah, you know, we've been hearing about dark money ever since 2010, the midterm elections 4 years ago. But this description of anonymous campaign spending really dominated the midterms this year. There was an editorial in the New York Times talking about how dark money was responsible for moving the Senate into Republican hands. And so because this campaign spending is so hard to track, that this term dark money seems to fit. It's sort of like dark matter in the universe or whatever.
Sounds like Star Wars.
Something. Yeah, exactly. So that one is a very resonant term, and I expect that we'll be hearing a lot about it in future campaign cycles.
We're talking right now with linguist Ben Zimmer about the words that defined the past year, and we're taking your suggestions, too. What do you think the word of 2014 should be? Did you come across any new words of the year that you think should be up for consideration? And what words do you find yourself getting kind of attached to and using over and over? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold filling in today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're taking a look back on some of the best words and phrases of 2014, words like vortex, cromnibus, and budtender. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What were some of your favorite words from the last year? Which ones stuck out and which ones have you been using? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And joining us to discuss this is Ben Zimmer. He's a linguist and the executive editor of Vocabulary.com and VisualThesaurus.com. He's also the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about new words that popped up this year. Are there other words that sort of jump into your mind, Ben, that are particularly interesting this year beyond the things we've discussed so far?
Well, there have been a lot of significant words and phrases that have been tied to the demonstrations that we've seen after grand juries have failed to indict police officers in the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. And slogans like hands up, don't shoot, or I can't breathe. Now, those slogans don't really qualify as words of the year. They're more like full sentences. But something like die-in, I think, was very prominent this year as a form of protest where people get on the ground and act like they've died. And that was a kind of a protest that actually originated back in 1970 on Earth Day in Boston. 1970, the first die-in occurred where protesters lied down. They were actually lying down in coffins for that particular protest. And it ties in with the civil rights protests, of course, sit-ins and teach-ins and lots of other forms of that where it's a word plus in. And die-in is one that's been used by anti-war activists, AIDS activists, and very prominently this year, the demonstrators over these cases involving Michael Brown and Eric Garner.
Now, do you feel like that there are some times where there are more words that are adopted because so many things are going on? Are there some years that are slow for this and some years that are faster?
Often is driven by current events. So, of course, in the years with elections, there might be a lot of political words, and you never can really predict what might happen. I mean, again, something like the die-in was very much driven by events and the protests that happened this year. And in other cases, it could be the Ebola outbreak, for instance, that causes people to use that word in various combinations as well. I mean, we heard about Ebola phobia or Ebola mania to describe the kind of panic that was engendered in the U.S. and other countries over the Ebola outbreak. So very often it's just reacting to current events and then finding the language used to describe that.
Technology is always another really fertile area for getting new words. And it seems like this year we've entered sort of new realms of creepiness, at least when we look at a word like droney. What's a droney?
a droney. Well, everyone's familiar now with the selfie, as a, you know, a term for a self-portrait. But and that has spawned all sorts of selfie variants, and one of the new ones is the droney. That's a video selfie that you take with a drone. So drone photography has become a big thing this year. Another term for a droney is a dronestagram. So that's combining drone with Instagram. Technology takes us in all sorts of interesting directions, and the language reflects that.
There's also one that I've noticed. I guess they're called portmanteau words. Is that right? So like Sharknado, for example, which is a really painful movie that's been made a couple times now. But there are a lot of things like that these days, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's that kind of blending or creating portmanteau words is always a popular form of neologizing, creating new words. Sometimes those blends or portmanteau words are more successful than others. There are some this year that just sounded strange. Like one that was coined this year was Platture, which blends platform and publisher. This is a term for online publishers. One example is Medium, where it's an online publisher that's also a platform for creating content. And so you combine platform and publisher and you get Platisher, which is just a terrible sounding word.
Yeah, sometimes I think people just want it too bad. They want it to work, yeah. But it just doesn't really sound like anything.
Sometimes the words succeed despite themselves. There was a lot of complaint about the word phablet, which combines the smartphones. Everybody thought, oh, what an ugly word. But there was no suggestion for any other word, and so people have just used that word phablet.
People still call them phablets then?
They do. Yeah, you do see that, especially in technology, blogging, and things like that.
That's a combo between phone and tablet, phablet.
Exactly.
I somehow managed to miss that one. But I'm going to be right on top of, I guess, the new word for taking selfies with a new device called a selfie stick.
The selfie stick, yeah. That's another direction that selfies have gone. This hit it big in Asia and now increasingly in the United States as well. Another term for it is the monopod, and this is a handheld pole that's extendable, and if you stick it out, then you can take a selfie of yourself from a distance using this gadget and without, you know, worrying about, you know, getting your hand in the picture or anything like that. And so you'll be seeing that more and more, I think, and selfie stick is the term for it.
Now, there's some other things like if you're a fan of, who's that guy from Coldplay? Chris Martin.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
I know where you're going with this.
They had conscious uncoupling.
That's right. Yeah, when Gwyneth Paltrow announced her separation from Chris Martin, she called it conscious uncoupling, and everyone said, what? What is that?
It's so much more pleasant than divorce.
You think people are
going
to pick that one up, though? You think that'll go anywhere?
Well, I think for the most part, people have picked it up in an ironic way because it sounds like such a euphemism for, you know, talking about splitting up. I looked into this a bit for the Wall Street Journal, and I found that this term actually comes out of the world of relationship counseling, and it's a way to sort of counselors have used it as a way to treat a subject that is often a taboo in our society, the dissolution of a marriage or a relationship, and to try to treat it in a positive way. But for most people, it sounds like this new agey euphemism, and so Gwyneth Paltrow got a lot of ribbing. There was a lot of reactions to her use of the term that it just seemed like a ridiculous euphemism.
Well, one of your words, Ben, that I'm definitely going to start using as soon as possible, if not sooner, is Columbusing. I think this is a brilliant word. Tell us where Columbusing came from.
Yeah, that's a clever term that came up. There was a video on the College Humor site that popularized it this year. And it satirizes the way that white people act like they discover things when they've actually been known by others for a long time. So in the same way that Christopher Columbus discovered America, even though obviously there were people living there already, it's a handy term to describe this kind of reappropriation or perhaps a misappropriation of things that might be popular among people of color. Things like African American slang would be a good example of Columbusing in action. And so a term that might derive from African American slang, one example this year would be bae, B-A-E, as a term for your loved one, like babe, but B-A-E, sometimes explained as an acronym for anyone else, but is really just a new form of the word babe. That's an example where it sort of has become reappropriated and treated as new, even though it's been around for a while in other cultures.
Now, there's one other that scares me, because I think that I've been this for many years, and that is normcore. What does that mean?
Yeah, we heard a lot about normcore this year as a kind of an anti-fashion trend, people wearing clothes that are just completely normal. If you imagine the clothes that Seinfeld wore in the 90s as an example of extremely normal kind of fashion. That was actually coined by a group called K-Hole, which was also trying to popularize the phrase acting basic. And so it's a way of being fashionable by being consciously unfashionable, a very kind of ironic fashion trend.
So I guess you're looking good, Mike.
Yes. I've always referred to myself as a parody of a normal guy. So now I have a term for it. Interesting.
Well, Ben, do you have any anti-words of the year? Where these ones are fun and usable and they have interesting backstories, but are there ones that you just can't stand and that we should immediately strike?
I try not to have that approach to language in general, when we vote on words of the year for the American Dialect Society, we're often actually looking for, other categories that we've created. So, for instance, least likely to succeed. And, one example that I thought was just kind of really silly, what happened in Utah this year, where there was a legislator in Utah who wanted to rewrite the laws to refer to same-sex marriage with a new word. He didn't want marriage referring to same-sex marriages. And so he suggested pairage, P-A-I-R-A-G-E, as his new word, so that same-sex marriages would no longer be called marriages anymore. So that, I think, would be a good example of a word that's least likely to succeed. I just do not see that catching on at all.
Well, it'll be fun to see what takes off in the new year. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks. Always a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Ben Zimmer. He's a linguist and the executive editor of Vocabulary.com and VisualThesaurus.com. He's also the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us to look back on the words that define 2014.
It's time for Wisconsin Life, and on today's program, we're talking about holiday traditions. You can join the conversation as well, and call and let us know what traditions you have in your family. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. But to prime the pump a little bit, we're going to hear a story from Alyssa Sagong, who tells us about how she found a new way to be part of an old tradition in her family.
My name is Alyssa Sagong, and I come from a German family predominantly, about half German on both my mother and my father's side, with a big smorgasbord of Luxembourg and Poland and other ethnicities thrown in there. I have a very nostalgic family, and I've been fortunate to be one of four living generations. I grew up knowing my great-grandparents and a great-great-aunt really well, and their nostalgia for traditions of the farm days in Kenosha and the parties that happened before my birth really stuck with me and still do. And I think that as a mother myself now, I have wanted to find a way to become a part of that nostalgia and put myself into that story. One way that that has happened has been the rebirth of the tradition of the Christmas brandy old-fashioned. Legend has it that my great-great-aunt threw the very best Christmas parties and was a generous hostess, and she and her husband would have a little bar in the basement where they'd mix up brandy old-fashions, which was special for Christmas because normally everybody drank brandy with water. So the brandy old fashions at Christmas were legendary, and brandy Alexander's after dinner. And a few years ago, my aunt started hosting a Christmas feast inspired by great-great-Aunt Lil's Christmas feast. And so, of course, brandy old fashions were a key component. But where did I fit into that tradition? I came across a recipe for old-fashioned bitters on America's Test Kitchen, and I thought, that's it. That is my place in this story. And I began researching it and reading through the detailed instructions of making these infusions, you know, all this alchemy that happened, and I knew that that was just my piece of the story. The process is really fun. I feel like my kitchen is a little laboratory. I line up all my mason jars and salsa jars and containers of different sizes and prepare the ingredients. Some of them, it's just measuring a quarter cup of mugwort into a cup of vodka to infuse for perhaps 5 days. And others involve taking the cardamom seeds out of the pod and then toasting them in a frying pan and filling your house with the aroma of cardamom before you add them to a smaller jar that might just need to sit for 2 days because it's a stronger essence. So I surprised everybody with the Christmas brandy old-fashioned bottle of bitters for the feast itself and for them to take home and remember the rest of the year, hopefully.
That story was produced by Judith Sears-Posson. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
And to continue that conversation, we'd love to hear from you right now. What are some of your family traditions around the holiday season? We heard about brandy old fashions there, homemade bitters. Well, do you have a food, a drink, a particular event, or a get-together that you have to do every year? It just isn't right. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe there's a tradition that your family used to do growing up. Now you want to bring it back. Tell us about it. And how do family traditions fit into your holiday season? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Again, the number is 800-642-1234. We heard from Susanna a little earlier who said that every year she snaps a picture of her granddaughter and her lighting Hanukkah candles. It's neat to see what has stayed the same and what has changed. Same menorah, new couch. She's grown up, and her hair is still gray. So maybe that's one of your traditions that you have, Susanna does.
And we've got another vote here from someone on WPR, Kathy Berenger, in our membership services. She's the manager. Her family goes to Christmas Eve service and then goes home for Chinese food and game playing. So not a lot of cooking going on. They get the church in, and then they kick back with the Chinese food.
Kay is another person who weighed in on this. She said, growing up, she always had oyster stew for dinner Christmas Eve. Oyster stew. I know people do that.
I've heard of that before.
I know people do that. But
it's hard to come by oysters in Wisconsin.
Never really happened. We are getting calls. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Holly in Wausau, a great name for the holidays, I guess. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First-time caller, long-time listener. Just had to call in. I actually was born on Christmas Day back in 1963, and so my mom has done really wonderful with celebrating the birthdays outside of the Christmas. However, 6 years after I was born, my little sister was also born on Christmas Day.
Oh, boy.
So it makes for a unique family tradition every year where, you know, we usually get together at one of the family members' house and we do the Christmas and the opening of the presents, and then we do birthdays in the afternoon. We do birthday cake and celebrate the birthdays and try to make that extra special. But my parents have always done really well making us still have a birthday even though it's on Christmas. And it is special that both me and my sister share that uniqueness together. And that's probably how I got the name Holly, and although her name is Jennifer.
So they gave up on the holiday-themed names after you.
Well, her middle name is Joy, so she kind of got it that way. But it is just kind of a unique thing that we have. And now that we're older, it is so special that we we spend time, I mean, we're together every year for our birthdays, and I think a lot of people, as we age, don't get to say we get to be with our families, and every year, you know, since we were born, we've had that special party, so.
Now, there's some people who are born around Christmas who really hate it because, you know, it kind of ruins their whole world. Did it help to have your sister be born the same day so you guys could kind of share that angst?
Definitely. I mean, you know, growing up, I mean, it was, you know, it's unique to have your birthday on Christmas, but then to have a sister who's, you know, 6 years younger, we're not twins. We've been in the paper over the years, and people remember your birthday. And yeah, now that we're older, it's a very unique, special thing.
Well, Holly, thanks for that call.
And you can join Holly at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got an open line for you to tell us about your must-do holiday tradition. And we have Karina from here at WPR saying, when my husband was growing up, his mom would always make floats with a fruit-flavored sherbet and 7-Up on Christmas Eve. His mom passed the tradition. So that tradition ended, but he told me about the tradition, and the first Christmas we spent together, she reinstated it. So the Christmas floats with the 7-Up and the sherbet, they're back. That's a fun one. Food is a great one. Do you guys have any traditions, Mike?
Awkward conversations. We're big on that. In my family, we like to spend a lot of time having those awkward conversations.
That sounds great.
Definitely.
Well, I can't compete with that, but we do have cheese fondue almost every year on Christmas Eve.
Oh, that's fun.
Sometimes we reach peak cheese before Christmas Eve, in which case, you know, we give it a pass for a year. But in general, you know, cheese is a safe bet in Wisconsin.
Yes. A couple more. Mary Mason, who works here at Wisconsin Public Radio, says her family gets together and bakes Christmas cookies on the Friday after Thanksgiving. They split up the cookies between the bakers, and several tins also get taken out to homebound friends and family. It's also a great time for people to do good things for other people, so that's a good example of that, definitely.
And we have fundraising manager Sarah, and her family has a cookie baking party too, more cookies, and a gift raffle each year with the raffle ticket proceeds going to charity. That's a fun one. And Brittany, who's running our board today, she says her family has a pancake breakfast bar. Dad is the chef in the morning. That's nice. It takes us a lot of pancakes to flip in the morning. Sometimes I'm not that motivated to get up on Christmas morning and make pancakes, so hats off.
All right. And let's see. How much time do we have? Could we quickly go to Felicia?
Yeah, sure, quick
Felicia
call.
From Madison. Welcome to the Central Time.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I was calling because my dad's married in the Leibersdorf family in Waukesha. And so we're Muslim converts, me and my husband. And we're always welcomed with actually kosher turkey for usually Christmas and Thanksgiving. And my dad makes a really big effort to sort of respect our religious, you know, food restrictions. And because we can eat kosher meat, he'll always have like a kosher turkey. And then we have like a general prayer to God, you know, that's sort of for all the family.
That's great, Felicia. Thanks for sharing that with us.
All right, thank you.
And if you'd like to continue the conversation, you can share your family traditions with us on the Central Time Facebook page. Thank you for all those calls and responses. You can also post a picture there if you can.